everyone, and welcome back to the Faculty of Horror podcasting from the Horrid Halls of Academia. I'm Alex West with
Andrea Subisati.
And while we are not quite in the dog days of summer, it is definitely getting a little bit warmer here in the Rue Morgue vault. There's not a lot of ventilation in this room,
No. But
we are so lucky to have this space, and we are here to talk about something that I really wanted to talk about for a while, something that I feel has always kind of simmered beneath the surface of real popular culture infiltration, but has a lot of love from horror fans, and that's werewolves.
Yeah, I feel like we've put it off because in our first year of podcasting, we did cover Ginger Snaps, and that was in the context of maturity and puberty, and that is a theme that comes up in a lot of werewolves, but Ginger Snaps does it so well that I felt like we blew our load. Like, what else do we have to say about this monster? So we took some time with it, and then we picked two movies that treat the subject very, very differently. Differently from each other, differently from Ginger Snaps, differently from a lot of werewolf movies, I'd say.
And there is a pretty big delineation when we talk about werewolves. There is, of course, the famous Universal Wolfman, who is part of the Universal Monsters. And then as you get into the 80s with films such as The Howling, The Company of Wolves, and another film we're going to talk about today, you have a more contemporary orientation on the werewolf mythos. And I think what's important is the Universal Monster and the Wolfman really bridged a gap between wolf as monster and wolf as tragic figure. And what I think contemporary werewolf films have done is continue to bridge that gap and look at different ways that animality and the beast within has come to kind of haunt and dictate elements of society.
Yeah, what's significant for me about werewolves is that they don't seem to have their heyday the way other monsters do. You know, we talk about zombies of the 60s and 70s, anxieties around consumerism, and vampires in the 80s and 90s, and anxieties about sex and disease. Werewolves don't really have that central allegorical thread in horror history that speak to a particular place and time. Like, they pop up in and out of horror here and there, either if somebody wants to take a novel spin on the mythos or if somebody wants to do a really badass transformation scene. That's a big challenge when it comes to werewolf movies. And indeed, one of the movies that we're going to be talking about is a huge showpiece for Rick Baker that won him an Oscar.
And I think it's important, before we delve into the two films we're going to talk about today, to touch on the history of werewolves. Now, I didn't actually know that much about the history of werewolves before I started researching this episode. And there is so much on them. They have such a storied history that's really deeply ingrained in a lot of anxiety and a lot of cultural revolutions. Now, werewolves have been a part of history and mythos since the first AD, like 1 AD. Ovid wrote about them, and there's the King Lycan, where you get the term lycanthropy and all of those things. So they existed in Greek mythos, and it's important to keep in mind that when we talk about the notion of transformation, shape-shifting, all of that kind of stuff, it existed all over the world. And it was determined by where you were in the world. So, for instance, in Japan, there were shape-shifting myths and fears and anxieties in, you know, pre-medieval times, but they were really concerned about wildcats. So you could be like a were-wildcat. Now, where we get into werewolves is really in European history, medieval European history, and that is because wolves were rampant in Europe. They were all over the place, and they killed a lot of people. Of course, as technology, weaponry, housing got better and more evolved over time, they became less of an issue, but it was still pretty easy to get torn apart by a werewolf.
We've got one in the studio.
We've got one in the studio, guys. So if you hear any little huffing and puffing, it's actually just Big Sweetie.
Big Sweetie threatening to blow our house down.
Maybe eat some Kleenex.
Yeah.
So as we look and as we've talked about history and the kind of merging of history and horror as we are wont to do in this podcast, there is a sense that the shape-shifting mythos was dependent on the biggest predator in the area. So, of course, in Europe, you've got wolves. What's kind of important to keep in mind when we talk about werewolves in medieval Europe is that they weren't turned by the moon. They weren't turned by a werewolf bite. They were seen as agents of the devil. They were seen as people who turned because they were cursed. They were evil. They had some kind of balm or salve put on them, which turned them into a wolf. There's also another big thing in the history of werewolves called the wolf girdle, which is kind of like a male corset. William Shatner was a big fan of them, and you would put that on and you could turn into a wolf. There are also wolf cloaks, things like that. You guys get the idea. Now, what I thought was very interesting and what I didn't know was that a lot of werewolves were accused alongside witches during the burning times and during the insane witch hunts in Europe and the UK. And I have a stat here that in France alone, there were over 30,000 people accused of being werewolves. And sometimes they were seen as familiars of witches, or they were just crazy bad dudes on their own. And when you went to accuse someone of being a werewolf, it was usually due to needing to blame someone on dead livestock. And of course, the kind of big thing in the burning times, which was blaming and getting rid of what were deemed undesirables within communities. Now, there was also an interesting subthread in these accusations. There were several serial killers accused of being werewolves. So it was seen as inhuman, unable to control their anger or their rage. There were a few really famous ones in France, such as Pierre Bergot, Michel Verdun, and Gilles Garnier. And there were several more across Europe, but France seemed to have a really big concentration of them. And another important thing to look at when you look at the history of werewolves is they were not turned because they had been bitten. Usually the werewolf mythos had to do with werewolves fully eating people. So there wasn't anything to be left to turn into a werewolf. It was a curse. It was something you didn't want, or maybe you did. And so the Roman Catholic Church at the time really saw this as an affront from the devil against God, and it was up to them to try them and burn them where they could.
Okay, so it was mostly men, I guess. Feminine counterpart was the witch who made a pact for powers.
Exactly. That's what turned up in my research time and again, was this seemed to be a male counterpart to the witches. Not always, but in a lot of cases, it was a lot of rampant male violence. There was a lot of rape, cannibalism, things like that. Those kind of things that you deemed bestial or uncontrollable male urges. It was like, oh, you're a werewolf, and Susan down the street saw you turn into a werewolf. So
that's interesting. We've talked about women being closer to nature, but we also talk about male drives being more animalistic in nature.
And when we talk about feminism, of course, when it applies to men, it's the kind of toxic masculine notion, which is really unfair to men, of saying, you know, you guys can't control your urges and you're a slave to your urges, which you're not. And so that's kind of the way the patriarchy likes to play it, is that women are the gatekeepers of our purity and our goodness, and men just can't help themselves. So, you know, we play a lot on those two things. So I think the werewolf, well, it has some kind of origin because there is a lot of fear and anxiety about the ferocity of wolves during this period. There is also a notion that these kind of urges, these desires, these needs, whether they were mental illness or just someone being kind of evil, stemmed from a lack of civility. And this was super important during the medieval era. We were eventually heading towards the Enlightenment, but the Roman Catholic Church was all about control and fortitude and certitude. And if you were unable to adapt, then you were an undesirable and you were kind of an outcast. So these were really clear, easy ways to delineate the good civility from the bad, quote-unquote savage, that we talk about when we talk about werewolves. So when you look at werewolves through a historical lens, there is a lot of evil, a lot of fear, a lot of things like that. And it wasn't really until Universal first reappropriated the werewolf figure in Werewolf of London in 1935, which was like kind of successful, not really, but then more successfully with the Wolfman in 1941.
And I suppose it's worth mentioning, not really, but the 2010 remake with Benicio del Toro and Anthony Hopkins met with really mixed reviews, but won an Oscar for makeup. And Universal has been rumbling about rebooting their classic monsters franchise for a shared universe series, starting with the Mummy movie, which is out right now and I haven't seen, but the reviews aren't good.
No, they're not, but there is an interesting thing where they've already kind of announced the perceived cast of who would round out the Universal Monster Universe. So not only do you have Tom Cruise in The Mummy, there's also Javier Bardem, I believe, is the Frankenstein monster.
Who's that?
I was in No Country for Old Men.
Oh, that guy. He's intense. Cool.
Yeah. And then everyone's former favorite, Johnny Depp, as the Invisible Man. But mm-hmm. I don't think anyone mentioned the Wolfman in the PR stuff I've seen.
I heard a rumor that the Wolfman is set for release in March of 2018 with possibly none other than Dwayne Johnson, a.k.a. The Rock, a.k.a. The People's Eyebrow. Anyways, werewolves, cursed, reluctant monsters, innocent people unaware of the death they inflict and helpless to stop it. I've mentioned that it's been used as a metaphor for puberty and transformation, as in Ginger Snaps and also the 1994 film Wolf with Jack Nicholson. You remember that?
Oh, I remember that.
It's the missing link between human and animal. So to set off our discussion, we are going to start with 1981's American Werewolf in London, directed by John Landis.
Did you hear that? What was it?
A coyote.
There aren't any coyotes in England.
What happened to them?
Well, the police report said they were attacked by an escaped lunatic. Must have been a very powerful man.
Jack and I were not attacked by a man.
It's an animal. A wolf.
Did he say a wolf?
Yes, I believe he did.
Did you get a good look at the man who attacked you?
Doctor, my memory is fine. It's my sanity I'm beginning to worry about.
You've never had bad dreams before?
Well, sure, as a kid, but never so real. Never so weird.
I'm going to look into your eyes.
My friend Jack was just here.
Your dead friend, Jack.
Hi, David.
He told me that I will become a monster in 2 days.
The supernatural, the power of darkness, it's all true.
Please believe me.
Believe what? That tomorrow night, beneath the full moon, I'll sprout hair and fangs and eat people?
You'd be surprised what horrors a man is capable of.
Are you all right now?
I don't know. I'll let you know the next full moon. I'm a werewolf.
You're gonna change. You'll kill people. You'll become...
I know. A monster.
David, don't lose control!
Control? What control?
David, I can help you.
No, I'm not safe to be with. You gotta stay away from me. Run!
David and Jack are two American backpackers traveling through northern England, and as night falls, they stop at the Slaughtered Lamb pub in a small town. The locals are awed, and when Jack and David inquire about the pentagram on the wall, they are told to leave the pub and are warned to stick to the roads. As the two friends walk, they drift away from the road, and they are attacked by a werewolf. Jack is brutally killed, and David is attacked but saved by the local villagers who intervene. David is taken to London to recover in a hospital. When he wakes up, he is informed that everyone believes a madman attacked them rather than a wolf. The ghost of Jack appears to David and tells him that he is cursed to turn into a werewolf at the next full moon. David also has graphic nightmares of Nazi werewolves attacking his family in their home in America. David is eventually discharged from the hospital and shacks up with the pretty nurse, Alex. As the two begin a relationship, Jack continues to warn David through visions of his curse. Sure enough, during the full moon, David turns and goes on a rampage, killing several people. The next day, Jack and the ghosts of his victims appear to him and tell him to kill himself before he hurts any more people. David then, of course, turns into a werewolf once again and wreaks havoc in London. He is cornered by the police and Alex in an alleyway. Alex has realized what is going on and tells the werewolf that she loves him. He snarls at her, and before he can attack, he is shot dead by the police at the scene. As he dies, he returns to his human form.
So sad.
It's very tragic, and I have to say, I have a slightly odd personal history with this film. It's one of my favorite werewolf movies. And as I was growing up, I was probably 10 or 11 when I first saw it. And, you know, my parents being my parents were like, oh, Alex is kind of getting into like the weird horror stuff. And this was a movie my dad went out, rented specifically, and showed me. And I was fucking horrified. It's a terrifying movie. It's bloody. It's upsetting. It also did not help that I think we had pretty recently just come back from a trip to England where we were going to see my dad's family. And my uncle lived up in Yorkshire, in the middle of nowhere Yorkshire, like in a small town that could have had the Slaughtered Lamb pub. And when they warn Jack and David not to go out into the moors,
stay on the road. Keep clear of the moors.
I used to go for walks on those moors all of the time. That would be the afternoon walk. And holy shit, are those things scary? Like, beautiful, but they are eerie. There's just like a weird mist that's always kind of low level and just these like empty stretches of land you're just walking through. And everyone has like a really intense accent up there because it's Northern England. And yeah, so this was something that felt very real and palpable in the course of my seeing it. And it's very violent and weird. And as charming and likable as so many of the characters are, the grotesque nature of the makeup that Rick Baker did, which is amazing. I think it was so interesting that I always get a little nervous every time Jack appears as a ghost in the film, because it's such a great performance. It's fun. It's light. It's what you need to kind of take the edge off the film. But the makeup is so horrifying, and that's what sticks with me.
Yeah, Jack especially. Like, the werewolf transformation scene is epic. But it's Jack, that first visit with that little woggle of skin hanging out his severed throat. It's gross.
And there's something so ominous just about, you know, the whole scene in the pub is really creepy and weird and I think really well done. But when they just say the simple thing of stick to the roads, it's so simple. And then you watch them in almost the next scene just not do it. And you're just like, I lose my mind every time I watch that, because I think as a horror fan, if you're in any situation and someone gives you like a small piece of advice, I'm like, I should just stick to that for the rest
of
my life.
You fucking take it. And it's not like they got distracted. It's not like something happened that they had to run off the road and they were scared by something. They just say like, whoops.
It's a full moon. Beware the moon. And stick to the road. Oops.
They're just chatting. They're chatting and they're probably a little nervous, so they're trying to relieve tension. And it all just goes wrong. And it goes wrong so quickly. And I think another thing that this film does well, because a lot of people bill it as a horror comedy, which, sure, I get that, but I think it's a much more emotional film than so many other horror comedies. And I love that John Landis left in the whole sequence of not only Jack getting attacked, which is terrifying and scary, but David running away from his friend.
Yeah.
Like, that's brutal. Like, just running from your friend to save yourself, because that is your, I guess, fight or flight instinct in that moment. Mm-hmm. And then when he comes to enough to run back to his friend and it's way too late, it's so devastating.
And I always found it interesting that in all of their interactions afterward, there was never any blame. They don't even really discuss it. Like, you took off, oh, but I came back. There was never any of that. It was just like, sorry about it, man. This happened. Now you got to do what you got to do. And it's that kind of really dry realism, the way the subject is approached in this film, that makes it really special. Now, I don't remember the first time I saw it at all. I'm pretty sure I was an adult. I don't have a vivid memory of being traumatized by it as a teen. But in rewatching it, I was more aware of its flaws. And it does have flaws. Basically, this is, I consider it a horror comedy. It's made by John Landis, who I consider a comedy filmmaker. He's very gregarious. He's very hilarious. He's made some of my favorite comedies of all time. Three Amigos. I will drop those references all the time. And Instant Friends with anyone who gets it.
Well, you slime-eating dogs, you scum-sucking pigs, you sons of a motherless goat.
Son of a motherless goat? And who are you?
The Three Amigos!
And even the production story of this film, the way it played out, like the lead, David Naughton, who plays David, he was hired having done this hilarious commercial where he's really jaunty and funny.
I drink Dr. Pepper and I'm proud. I used to be alone in a crowd. But now you look around these days, there seems to be a Dr. Pepper craze. I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too? I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, if you drink Dr. Pepper, you're a pepper too.
And then Jack is played by Griffin Dunne, who never actually auditioned but hit it off with Landis. So it was something that John Landis wanted to do. It was a script that he came up with, and he put it together. It's got a lot of laughs. It's got a lot of heart. It's got a lot of horror, and it's got a lot of flaws. But all these things come together to make a very endearing and timeless picture, in my opinion.
One of the big problems I've had with the film is I've gone back to it over the years and watched it with people and gone to screenings of it. It's something that the more I watch it, the more I can't ignore it. I feel like the love story is so lifeless.
Yeah.
It's a little painful to watch, and it's not because I think either of the actors is bad. It's just, to me, in my mind, such a clear case of there being so little chemistry. And it's a bit hard to watch because I find David Naughton's performance as David super charming, really likable. He's a good-looking guy. That's totally a guy I would go for. And Jenny Agutter, who plays Alex, she's doing the prim, uptight, you know, kind of British thing, and it's supposed to be that opposites attract thing.
Mm.
But I never got why. I never had that moment of these two people really are into each other. So it always feels like that moment, and they drop hints throughout the movie from other films that the only person who can kill a werewolf is someone who loves them.
I think that a werewolf can only be killed by someone who loves him.
What are you talking about?
I don't know what I'm talking about.
And when I get to that moment at the end of the film, I'm more sad because I know there's a good guy in that werewolf than I am for Alex losing a partner.
That's right.
And I wish I was. I wish I was more invested in that relationship, but it feels a bit too pat. There is so much more time developed between Jack and David, mm-hmm. especially in the afterlife, that I have a much deeper appreciation of that relationship. And then when you have to balance it with a love story, it just feels so rote. And I think this is something that comes up time and again when you talk about film, is you fall into this Audrey Hepburn, Spencer Tracy thing of the opposites attract.
Mm-hmm.
He's like a loose guy and she's an uptight girl. And, oh gosh, they just can't help it. And I think a lot of filmmakers rely on those tropes.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes, it doesn't serve the story in a real or interesting way to me.
Right. Yeah, I think it's exacerbated by the fact that this film really wants to put America in contradistinction to the UK, which is a little bit hard for me to bend my brain around. I don't know a whole lot about British culture. And I think of globalization and watching this film and just seeing all of the Disney toys and stuff at Alex's house. I feel like this film kind of makes some pretty unsubtle references to American culture bleeding into British culture and British culture being maybe more authentic, and American garishness is kind of tainting it a little bit. So I really felt like the crux of their love story was the fact that she's like, oh, you know, I haven't been with many men and I am not in the habit of taking home strange men.
I'll be perfectly honest with you, David. I'm not in the habit of bringing home stray young American men.
But he wins her over and he breaks down those walls with his brash, charming Americanness.
What Andrea just mentioned about American culture and British culture has been my entry point into this kind of rethinking of American Werewolf in London for this podcast. And it started with, why the UK? It's part of the title. It's right there. And I couldn't immediately discern why. So I, as I was doing my research, went and looked into werewolves in London or the UK or anywhere on that British Isle in general.
Mm-hmm.
And interesting fact, wolves were pretty much extinct or near extinct in Great Britain by about 1485 or 1509, depending on who you talk to, under the reign of King Henry January the 7th, and this was due to hunting and deforestation. And so the British don't have the same lineage of werewolves, werewolf mythos, the kind of fear of wolves that, say, mainland Europe does. And so then I got back to thinking, as, you know, we've already mentioned, Werewolf in London. Okay, that's a link, the first Universal movie, and then The Wolfman. And those were both set in England. In the case of Werewolf of London, it's a scientist who is bitten in Tibet by a werewolf and then returns home to London. The Wolfman in 1941, Lon Chaney Jr., is in Wales, which is part of the United Kingdom. So it has a very kind of British ethos to it. And obviously, you know, when we talk about the universal monsters, as Andrea mentioned, two of the big ones, Dracula and Frankenstein, or Frankenstein's monster, as we have talked about on this podcast, both come from literary traditions, as Andrea mentioned, via Mary Shelley and Bram Stoker from, you know, the United Kingdom. So there is that sense of sort of Britishness, Irishness, Scottishness, Walesishness, Welshness, got there, to them. And I think there's also, and then there's also something of, these are Hollywood films, you know, The Werewolf in London and The Wolfman are both Universal films. And Hollywood, when it does something highbrow, likes to set it in England, or likes to give a lot of British actors British accents, even if they're not in England. You know, see anything like Schindler's List, Gladiator, anything like that. You've got a bunch of actors who aren't in England walking around with British accent. And that's kind of a historical period piece that situates it for an American audience as something highbrow. And I'm sure there's a lot of scholarship around that, which I find very interesting. Probably dates back to colonialism and a lot of our kind of weird anxiety issues about all of that. So what I take from the setting of the UK is that Landis is indebted to the werewolf monsters of yore. They were things that were set against these kind of creepy moors and these. The UK is not a big place. Like, it's relatively small, all things considered. But there's a lot of emptiness, especially when you get outside of London. And one of the things I found is I've been fortunate enough to travel quite a bit around England. And one of the things I will say is that London is an amazing city. It is so big, though. It is so big. And I think I figured out the tube system once, and it was very exciting for me. And no one wants to talk to you in London. I would basically stay at my family's house, go into London, and go do stuff for the day, and then come home at the end of the night. And I'd be walking around with a big fucking map. I looked like Tourist 101. I was just like, I was in my early 20s and just figuring it out. And then, because I have aunts and uncles up in the north of England, I would go up to Liverpool, Yorkshire, wherever I could get up to see them. And oh my gosh, they are so lovely up there. It's almost like you get past the south or like Birmingham or something, like that kind of Midlands area, and then everyone wants to help you. Everyone's your best friend. I was carrying my like England tourist book of maps or whatever the fuck I had. I was trying to get to Yorkshire, around Yorkshire, to the right train station, and an old woman stopped me, just saw my book, and was like, oh, would you like some help? And just, like, gave me the loveliest advice and, like, walked with me for a little bit and was so kind.
That's nice.
And so it's this huge dichotomy within this very small island. Now, what I will say is that kind of speaks to the emptiness of the Yorkshire town where David and Jack are initially attacked, and then the anonymity that David feels within London, the fact that he can kind of get away for a whole day of not being caught after he's killed a bunch of people as a werewolf. No one wants to deal with it. They're also, everything's so disconnected that it doesn't feel quite real. And I think that's a very interesting distinction between the small town in Yorkshire that is so protective of their guilt, of their history, of everything that exists within them, and they don't want to let outsiders in. Whereas in London, you can kind of do whatever you want.
Right. I feel like that contradistinction between London and the place where they encounter the slaughtered lamb, they try to draw a very stark distinction between the superstitious, insular people and London, which is more modern but still has a really stiff upper lip. And then you've got this American, this brash, colorful American who is also a little bit of an outsider. There's a lot of references pointing to his Jewishness. It's very conspicuous and perhaps a little bit autobiographical of Landis, and I'm sure we're going to get into that nightmare sequence in due course. But a lot of lines are drawn between people within this film.
There are definitely lines between characters, whether it's class, status, religious backgrounds, anything like that within this film. They're very predominant, I find. And I think what's important to consider is that when we look at the first images of when we meet David and Jack, mm-hmm. they're on the back of this truck being dropped off with a bunch of sheep.
Sheep.
So immediately, where does your mind go except, at least for me, wolf in sheep's clothing?
Oh, I was more thinking these kids are dead. They're lambs being fed to the slaughter.
And then exactly, they go to the pub and it's a slaughtered lamb, but it's a picture of a wolf.
Right.
So there's all this kind of like misdirect about who's the predator, who's the prey, all of that. And I think that feeds into what is the monster. And that's the real question. And the monster in this film is kind of the lack of inclusion, the lack of intersectionality, lack of any kind of fear of an outsider. Mm. There is so much wanting to contain this werewolf within this small town. And we don't actually get a lot of backstory on it. And we do get a bit more about it kind of later on in the film. But there isn't a whole bunch that explains why it is, except it's an insular culture, it's a small island, and, you know, that's the thing, the fear of, you know, small town way of life being taken away from villagers, mm-hmm. even all the secrets that you keep, because you know everyone's secrets. Mm-hmm. Where again, as I was mentioning before, you've got the anonymity of a really big city, mm-hmm. and you've got all of this space to play around with, and you can get away with so much. Mm-hmm. And the way that, you know, when we talk about the wolf in sheep's clothing, the fact that David is a sheep for so much of it in that context, he's just kind of an affable guy who's just trying to make sense of this horrible tragedy that happened to him while he's falling in love. And he can't help this thing that comes out of him that is a bit like a Trojan horse that he just gets to kind of walk through these cultural spheres and interact with a lot of different people without any suspicion or fear of him. Mm-hmm. And then it all goes horribly wrong so quickly.
That's right. There is a lot of gatekeeping. There's definitely the people at the slaughtered lamb. But even when he's in the hospital, I feel like the way he's being treated by the doctors, the way he's being spoken to by the police, they're just kind of like, this happened and it's all covered up. Okay, that's fine. The guy from the U.S. Embassy is a fun cameo by Frank Oz, and it's just bizarre.
These dumbass kids, they never appreciate anything you do for them.
I guess it's supposed to be funny, but I found it really confusing. I actually find a lot of that hospital sequence really confusing. There's a lot of nightmare sequences that happen in there, which I guess is to liven it up. And again, to kill time, because the full moon, that happens once a month. And we see David transform within what feels like a couple of days. So I truly do feel like that was just to kind of liven up the dry hospital time along with these bumbling cops, right? But I also saw kind of the seeds of critique of backpacker culture. And this is early. I think the biggest movie that attacked it was in the year 2000 with Danny Boyle's The Beach. Do you remember that film?
Oh, yeah.
I loved that movie, and it was just a fun cautionary tale about the advent of the craze, which is these millennials who are so desperate for authenticity, Westerners who, like, just want to see something untouched by commercial tourism. And the danger with that movie was the extent to which people would go to protect their privacy. So that's something that we see in this film again. We never learn why the fuck Jack and David were in Yorkshire.
And I will say, Yorkshire is beautiful. It's lovely. I definitely recommend going to it if you've got time to kill in England. I don't know why you would go there as a backpacker.
Right? Like, I feel like they're just traveling for kicks, right? They're young, they're college age, they're probably shirking life slash adulthood.
Now, I will say this, which I think is quite interesting when we talk about Northern England, especially recent Northern England, as recent as 2016. There were several werewolf sightings in Hull, which is, I believe, the major city in Yorkshire, of a werewolf. And this was picked up from everything from the amazing British tabloids to Huffington Post UK. And there was some people laughing at it, a lot of people really scared. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a very interesting thing because there aren't any wolves in England. Again, as you see them in the film, they're in the zoo.
Hmm.
Because that's where they exist. Because you have to bring them into their country. And as I was looking at this, because I remembered seeing something about this last year, and again, it was around summer through the fall last year, and I found an interview with Dr. Sam George, who I guess ran the Werewolf Conference at the University of Hertfordshire, I believe last year, so 2016, and they asked her, why do you think people are starting to see werewolves in Hull, in mm-hmm. a relatively major city in England? And she attributed that sight of a werewolf to this kind of innate guilt that existed in England over having wiped out an entire indigenous species. Mm. So I don't necessarily agree with that. My father's British. I don't think he walks around every day with the guilt that his people killed all of the wolves. Not that he's told me anyway. maybe that's why he showed me this movie when I was 10. Who knows? But it kind of made me start thinking again about the Nazi werewolf sequences within the film, because mm-hmm. they are so sharp, they are so violent, they are so vividly realized. Mm-hmm. And again, there are a couple subtle mentions of David being Jewish in the film. They're a bit throwaway.
Chart says he's from New York.
Well, I think he's a Jew.
What makes you say that?
I've had a look.
Really, Susan, that wasn't very proper.
And then started Googling and researching and pulling my books out of the shelves. And I came across this really great article, and it was on the British Film Institute site. So we will link it in the show notes, by a film writer named John Spira. And he talks about being the only Jewish kid on his block when he was growing up in England, and, you know, seeing this film and then eventually realizing, oh, the main character is Jewish and he's cool and he's handsome and he gets girls and he's funny and I like him. And how that was really different from him. And for him, the Nazi dream sequences allude to a fear that Western society could turn on perceived interlopers on any given moment, which he writes about so beautifully. Again, I encourage you, check the show notes. The article will be linked there. It's such a thoughtful, emotional piece. And that really got me. It kind of made me start thinking that if David in this film, as I think anyone would perceive Nazis as monsters, then maybe it makes sense that he's thinking of them as werewolves. You know, they're monsters, they're evil, they're just going to kill everything. And then the journey of the film is him realizing that Nazis and evil people sometimes are coerced, they are forced, they are misled down these paths which they can't control, and their fate is kind of sealed in a weird way, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, yeah, that's, I think that's absolutely valid. I hadn't taken it there. I was just thinking of, you know, John Landis as a Jewish man who was born very shortly after the Second World War, just kind of dreaming up the worst possible scenario he could think of. And the fact that this is David witnessing the brutal and untimely demise of his entire family, he was just kind of internalizing the fact that I am a threat and I am going to hurt those that I love. And I'm actually kind of glad that the dream sequence went there instead of him attacking Alex or something.
Yeah, it's such an interesting element of the film, and I love that they don't explain it. I love that it's not a sit-down with Alex where he's like, got to explain all these feelings I have inside now, and I think this is what they mean. I like that it's this thing, and I think through doing so, as we've both just done, you pull different things out of that. Mm-hmm. And I think that, for me, those sequences speak to the cursedness, the coercion, the bad things that happen to people that make them bad, mm-hmm. and how sometimes they are very much out of our control. So again, it kind of plays into, for me, a more contemporary iteration of the wolfman or the werewolf as a humanistic monster. Someone who something bad just happened to. They were at the wrong place at the wrong time. There's a sense of, you know, when we speak about other monsters like vampires, yes, they're bitten, they turn, they walk the earth forever. But there's something that kind of changes within them, and they're always a bit evil. They have a more pronounced evilness. And I think the tragedy of the werewolf or the werewolf figure is that they have a kind of full and complete consciousness, you know, 28 days out of the month, and then they're scared of it for the rest of their lives.
And that kind of makes it a little bit more tragic, is that David feels great. As a werewolf, he feels fantastic. He's got voracious sexual appetite. He's got all this energy. Like, he's living it up. So it just sets him up to be that much more tragic. Now, forgive me if I'm speaking way out of line here, but I can't help but notice that last year there's reports of werewolves in Yorkshire, and something else happened of significance last year in the UK.
Brexit?
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, just with regard with what you were saying with the witch hunt, like, I can't help but see parallels with xenophobia.
I think that's a really interesting point. And I think what happened with Brexit, and having spoke to several people recently who all live in the UK, they were all super liberal. They all voted no, don't leave. Mm-hmm. They all voted, I believe, Jeremy Corbyn in the recent prime minister elections, as opposed to the conservative Theresa May. And they feel as though there are a lot of lies and a lot of things going wrong in the country. I mean, currently, they've just suffered several major terrorist attacks. They recently had the huge fire in the apartment complex in London, which a lot of people have come out and spoken against, is that the apartment complex is in the middle of a very posh area of London. And if you've been to London in recent years, you'll know that pretty much all of it is super posh. Like, the areas my dad used to go to, which were, like, run down, or, like, you don't go there after dark, or if you're a woman, you don't go there, are now, like, Keira Knightley has a home there. You know, it's something like that. So there is this huge sense of gentrification that is kind of sinister, and you're really pushing people who need housing and need access to jobs away from the city centers where they can get them. And recently, my best friend, she moved to the UK. She moved to a little town called Tamworth, which is about 20 minutes outside of Birmingham, to be with her boyfriend. And she came back to Toronto recently, and we were chatting. And I was like, what's it like in Tamworth? And she said, she was like, I'm the most foreign person that has maybe ever been in Tamworth.
Wow.
And she's Canadian. She's like white, blonde hair, blue eyes. And they're all like, say tomato again. And she's like, that's funny. It's charming. But there is a real conservative bent to the town. And there's huge pockets of England that are still like that. I think there are still huge pockets of the world that are like that. And, you know, for me, having grown up as a city girl, you don't experience that as much. But there are these small enclaves which, you know, still have that kind of colonial attitude, that we are the biggest empire attitude. And that's not the case anymore.
No. So, not to wrap up discussion of this film, because I feel like we're going to refer back to it in our discussion of the next film, I feel like it bears mention that a remake has been rumored. You didn't know about this?
I didn't. I started to roll my eyes and then I stopped, because I'm not surprised when you say there's a rumored remake of a film we're about to talk about on this podcast.
Hold on to your eye rolling, because the remake is rumored to have John Landis's son, Max Landis, attached. And the eye roll for me was seeing the fans who are just kind of like, oh, well, then it's going to be good. Now I'm excited. I am suspicious of most remakes, but if this has the same DNA of a movie that I like, what the fuck kind of rationale is that?
My dad was nominated for an Academy Award, like, as a director. No one should let me direct a movie.
I'd let you direct a movie.
I know.
You're going to direct my autobiography. Starring who? Remind me?
Oh, Janine Garofalo?
Right.
I think I'd be really very good at a filibuster because I'm undisciplined. I can't remember what I was going to say. There's tangents. I'm chatty.
I'm going to say we would be remiss if we didn't mention the sequel to this film, just for our academic nature of this podcast, and that is An American Werewolf in Paris. I have not seen this film.
Not ever. Okay.
It was just kind of a, I don't know. I rewatched the trailer last night thinking, oh, I maybe have some time tonight. I can watch it. Mm. And I just watched the trailer and I was like, ugh, this seems awful. Apologies to any fans out there. It just didn't grab me. And it's been pretty much largely forgotten by the horror community, I think. It was done in, I believe, 97 or 98. And it doesn't have a lot of love out there.
No.
So if you are out there and you love Tom Everett Scott and Julie Delpy, you know, this is a good time for, I don't know, magazine pitch, blog post, something like that. Write about why that movie's great, because nice. No one else is talking about it. And I think that kind of came around after the Scream heyday. There was a lot of reboots, a lot of interest in teen slashers. Mm-hmm. And it's too off-center from that.
Right.
And I think they tried to age it up by, like, having backpackers again in their 20s. Mm-hmm. And it didn't work from everything I could read about it last night before I got bored and distracted by something my roommate's cat did. So that exists. And again, when we talk about remakes, when we talk about reboots, when we talk about new Universal monsters, all that jazz, you know, it's important to keep in mind the films that we do love. And I think despite my small, I'd say relatively small issues with this film, it's pretty seminal.
Oh, yeah.
It's really great. It gets me in so many ways that so many other movies don't. It surprises me every time I watch it. Again, Rick Baker won the first Academy Award for special effects makeup for this film. And again, while the werewolf transformation is iconic, there are so many other moments with Griffin Dunne as Jack kind of slowly deteriorating. It's a really special film, and I think that's why it's one of those horror films that I would say is firmly horror, which pulls in from, you know, different influences, but has gone a bit more mainstream. And I think there's a good reason for that.
I agree.
Well, I think with everything wrapped up in London, we should do a little hop, skip, and a jump across the pond. Not that pond, the other pond. You're going to want to go the other way. And I think now we're going to talk about Christoph Gans' 2001 film, Brotherhood of the Wolf.
It was 1764 after the year of our Lord when it appeared from the forest of Gévaudan. It was feared no mortal could ever free us from the sharp grip of the beast. And then, at the darkest hour, the king sent two men.
So this film's plot is all over the place, but here goes. The movie begins with a middle-aged man writing his memoir while the French Revolution rages outside his castle. In his memoir, he recounts the story of Grégoire de Fronsac, a naturalist sent by the King of France to investigate claims that a beast is terrorizing the province of Gévaudan. Fronsac shows up with his First Nations companion Manny, and the two begin investigating gruesome murders that the locals seem to attribute to a werewolf. Fronsac is a man of science, so he rejects any supernatural explanation, but he's also a Frenchman, so he wastes no time in wooing the aristocrat Marianne and banging an Italian prostitute at a local brothel. Complicating matters are Marianne's creepy one-armed brother Jean-Francois, the hostility of the locals who are suspicious of Manny, and the circulation of a book called L'Édifiant, which claims that the beast is of demonic origin and has been sent to punish the king for putting science above religion. So the story unfolds with more twists and turns than I can even comprehend, much less describe. But suffice it to say that shit gets personal when the local Romani tribe capture and kill Manny, and Marianne finds out about the Italian whore, and the king takes Fronsac off the mission and puts some asshole in charge instead. Fronsac goes rogue, dies, comes back to life, reunites with Marianne, kills all the Romanis, and exposes a giant red-robed cult referred to as the Brotherhood of the Wolf, who were disseminating that book in an effort to rally the locals into overthrowing the king. The beast, as it turns out, was just a friggin' African lion that the Romanis embellished with spikes and armor and trained to be vicious. Fast forward back to the French Revolution, and the narrator, who was some sympathetic character in the midst of all this Fronsac shit, is about to be executed by the mob. Is he worried about his impending death or the bleak future of France? Mais non. His final thoughts are that he hopes Fronsac and Marianne are happy somewhere and making out on a boat. So part of the reason this film is going to play an interesting part of this discussion is because it couldn't be more different from An American Werewolf in London. It's different in terms of its fun level. Like, the film's theatrical version, which is the one that I saw, is a whopping 142 minutes, but it feels even longer. Not because it isn't entertaining, but because there's so many highs and lows and plots and subplots and climaxes and mini climaxes that watching it feels like binging a period show on Netflix. For our purposes, I think what's useful for the Brotherhood of the Wolf is that the wolf is very much externalized. Like, the wolf is still a tragic figure. It's still an innocent pawn kind of in all this that's happening, but it's not so much about the wolf as what's going on around it.
Yeah, this film, and the first time I saw it was for this episode, and so the film actually makes a lot more sense to me in the context of a werewolf film once I got into the history of werewolves. When you look at the fear and anxiety that existed even before the French Revolution around werewolves, like through the 16th century in France, with so many men, especially men, being accused of being werewolves. And so it makes sense that this is part of their ideology. This is part of the culture at the time, even though it's kind of slowly being phased out. And the Brotherhood of the Wolf is actually based on a real historical incident of the Beast of Givaudan. And this beast, which was either believed now to have been a pack of wolves or some kind of hyena or some kind of crossbreed between a house dog and a wolf or something like that, during its, let's say, reign between 1764 and 1767, attacked 220 people and actually killed 113. And this was in a more provincial area of France, not in Paris, not within one of the major cities, but still an aristocratic place, let's say. And King Louis XV, who was in charge and in large at that time, used a lot of extensive resources to capture the animal because it was such a real concern to the people of France at that time. And so I think it's interesting that Christophe Gans, who we talked about very recently in our Silent Hill episode, tackled this notion of French history. And I think what is very interesting is to look at Gans as a filmmaker. So obviously we talked about him in the early 2000s. A few years later on from this, when he made Silent Hill, his first big studio American film, he had made one film before this, but he really very much in my mind is a student of what a lot of French film critics called cinéma du look. That's L-O-O-K. And this kind of cinema came about in the 1980s in France. And one of the big proprietors of it was another filmmaker you may have heard of called Luc Besson, who initially made films like La Femme Nikita, then went on to The Professional or Léon. And we kind of hit big international acclaim with The Fifth Element. Now, Cinéma du Look was a response to the Hollywoodization of the blockbuster film, which really began in the 70s, but then kind of came into its heyday. And again, we're in the summer season now, so it's a blockbuster every goddamn weekend. And what was happening was, so a film like Raiders of the Lost Ark, the Indiana Jones film, was not just a hit in America. It was a hit all over the world. So it was kind of a causality that international film had to at least look at becoming an international sensation. So looking at genre films, action films, big epic films that could appeal to a lot of audiences to create big box office. So I think Fifth Element was a really big step towards that. And I think Brotherhood of the Wolf, though it's a much smaller film than any Hollywood blockbuster, certainly has a lot of tenets of it in terms of the action, the romance, the kind of genre elements of it that play into what the film is.
That's right. And there's no way this film was inexpensively made, I'll put it that way. There's very grand combat sequences. In fact, that sequence where they're trying to trap the beast and they've got all these crazy booby traps that he just blasts through, I was fixated. So as Alex was saying, this is based on a true story of a series of killings in France in the 18th century. And as a fun little aside, if you've ever played that nightmare game from the 80s with the VHS tape, Givaudan is the name of the werewolf. fun fact. I never knew why. I played it actually recently, and I was like, where does that come from? Now I know. So the Beast was rumored to be a giant red and black wolf reflected in the film, tearing out everyone's throats. And as Alex said, the Kingdom of France devoted a lot of resources to hunting it down. So the film is set in the 18th century as well, the Enlightenment era, the so-called Age of Reason, where people were pretty much fed up with feudalism and living in shit conditions while Marie Antoinette tells them to eat cake.
Well, and to be fair, during the Enlightenment, which was essentially, for anyone who doesn't know, the Enlightenment was the period where they were like, maybe there's other stuff than God. Maybe the church shouldn't be in charge of everything. Who's the king? Is God real? Like, I'm really paring it down when I say that, but it was really a step towards kind of a modern day democracy again, moving away from the feudal system and towards a more reasoned experience and a reasoned living for a lot of people. And while this was going on, a lot of the elements that were dictated through Enlightenment, which was the rights of men and women, well, mainly men at this period, all over the land, kind of came into contrast with the monarchy system and the church doctrines, which were heavily at play then. So it created a lot of tension. So while some people were enlightened and willing to work towards something close to equality or something that resembles equality, there are still huge swaths of the people and the land who had power before and weren't ready to give that up.
That's right. It was a time of great social and cultural change, which I feel like this film really tries to tackle them all at the same time in one cohesive narrative, which I feel like it doesn't really pull off. Well, we should talk about science, because Fronsac is introduced to us as somebody who has traveled, as somebody who is seasoned. And even though he doesn't believe in magic and hocus pocus, he does respect Manny's wisdom with regard to nature. And he seems to have progressed beyond the kind of basic racism that permeates the rest of the country. And that includes the townspeople and the elite alike. The elite are suspicious of Manny and the Romani people are outright hostile to him. This was also a time where science was being used to justify racism. So the idea that the white man was at the top of the evolutionary ladder, which justified subjugating the savages in Africa as well as in North America, these are things that come up in the film. And there was also that fun little nugget about the smallpox blankets in Quebec. Did you pick up on that?
Oh, yeah. This film actually has a lot of kind of callbacks. I think a lot of people associate colonialism with the English, as we were just talking a little bit about. But France had a big, big hand in that as well. And in Canada, you know, that's why we have a whole province called Quebec, which was kind of settled by the French, and there was a lot of wars in Canada between the French and the British over our land.
Mm-hmm. So whereas an American werewolf in London tries to draw a lot of lines between like the civil Englishman and the civil American, and then the civil Englishman in the rural area as opposed to the urban, this film draws a lot of lines between the aristocracy and then different marginalized groups. Now we've got the Beast is, it's just a lion that human beings have turned into a monster to meet their own ends. So that in and of itself is just kind of the use of science to draw these lines. They're manipulating nature to manipulate people, which is actually a neat little criticism of Enlightenment thinking, where European whites have put themselves at such a distance from nature through science. It's like they think they're the puppeteers when indeed they're slaves to their own passions and drives and aren't above something like, say, banging a prostitute when you're in love with someone else or raping your sister.
Well, it helps when the prostitute is Monica Bellucci and she can rattle off some stuff about some other stuff and, you know, that other time when you're looking at her naked and then her body transforms into a wintry vista.
There's so many things that bug me about how her character was portrayed, and I think the worst of it is how unnecessary all that sexy sex was. Like, could that not have been a little intrigue that he was like, no, I love Marianne, but you are very sexy and enticing, and they have a thing. And then when he's ousted for the affair, he's just like, I don't understand any of this. It's like, well, it's pretty fucking straightforward, man.
I mean, for me personally, while we're talking about David and Alex and the other film, I mean, I found the relationship between Fronsac and Marianne to be like a damp cloth talking to a damper cloth. I didn't really, that was an even further step to, I don't know why these two people are so devoted to each other.
No.
I am a really big fan of Monica Bellucci. I think she's a wonderful actress, and I think she kind of brings out a certain attraction and sexuality in a lot of the roles she plays, mm-hmm. and just through how mesmerizing she is on screen. I think if anyone out there has seen the film Irreversible, well, it's a very traumatic rape scene for her right at the beginning of the film. There are all these, like, really tender, amazing, intimate scenes between her. I know they were together at the time. I don't know if they were married at this point, but between her and Vincent Cassel, who's also in this film, he plays the one-armed brother, she just kind of evokes this interesting, like, intense intimacy whenever she's on screen, and I really, really dig it. I think she did a lot of heavy lifting in this film. I don't know if it was needed. I still don't understand this film.
Okay. So it's interesting to me that the narrator of the story is the most sympathetic aristocrat of the bunch, but he's the one who resigns himself with this quiet dignity to being executed by the mob. And it's interesting to me because looking back, the revolution, it didn't fix all of France's problems, not by a long shot. Like, life became increasingly authoritarian, militaristic. There was armed conflict with other nations. And so my guess is that this Marquis is essentially reflecting on why the French people are so pissed at the aristocracy. He's reflecting on a story where their lives were essentially being used as political pawns, and he's just resigning himself to his fate at having been on the wrong side at the wrong time.
Well, I was thinking about this, and for me, one of the most interesting lines in the film is a line that this character, Thomas, writes at the very beginning of the film.
Convictions can make men blind and drive them mad. They can devour their hearts and transform them into beasts.
That's not only just a very interesting statement in general, I think a very true statement in general, but it spoke to me again about the film culture in France. And France has this filmic history of wanting to, again, like something that is in Hollywood, you're wanting to show the best of your country and you're wanting to make national cinema. You get money from the government. You're doing all this. And I say that as a Canadian, and most of our films are Canadian government money films,
yep.
that just tell nice stories about Canada. And very, very rarely do we get, like, fucked up Cronenberg shit or, like, a fucked up Ginger Snaps. So when Christoph Gans was kind of coming up in the 80s and 90s as a film fan, he had, like, a film magazine, a film zine, and he was really into martial arts and Asian film and genre film in general. And a lot of that stuff is so shunned in France. And when I wrote my book, I talk a lot about how horror in particular is shunned in France. It's, you know, they literally look down their noses at it. And, you know, historically, when we look back at the French Revolution, it's a time when things looked like they could really change. The people rose up, they demanded change, and they got it, sometimes at really, really brutal means. And the time that Thomas is talking about within the film, it's when it turns into the terror, which were just like people were being ripped limb from limb, and it was fucking scary, and it was fucking weird, and there was so much chaos. And truly, everything I've read about that period is really upsetting and really dark, even though they were fighting sometimes for good ideals. And it seemed to kind of be this call out when you're looking at a 2001 context when the film was made, that film critics should not be so steeped in what they do, and they should not be so steeped in looking at French as a national cinema and something that promotes France as a country, that it has to be more diverse, more anything else than what it has mm-hmm. been. It can't play on the world stage as it once did.
That's right. That was definitely the case with Canada. If you look at the tax shelter era, as all the censorship of anything made with taxpayer money should reflect very flatteringly back on Canadian people. And Cronenberg got a really hard time for that, which is so ironic because he's a national treasure and often what people think of when they think of Canadian cinema.
And I think it's also important to note that the year this film was released in 2001 was also the release year of another kind of little film called Amélie. And if you haven't seen Amélie, it's a very cutesy, a very twee, a very cute, I don't know what it is, some kind of film that frames as a romantic comedy that strives to be really weird and outside the box.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in some ways it is. I think it's also very straightforward in a lot of other ways.
Mm-hmm.
But this was a small French film made after Jean-Pierre Jeunet made Alien Resurrection, as we talked about last year, came back and made this. And then it was this kind of like cult film sensation. Within film circles, it was like lauded. It was talked about. It's now a musical on Broadway. Like it's its own little industry of this France that everyone likes. And I think when you look at Brotherhood of the Wolf as a kind of parallel to that, it's a genre parallel. Mm-hmm. And while it didn't have the same cultural impact as Amelie, it did still have an impact. It was still a really successful movie for what it was at the time. It still got a theatrical release in North America, and it's really, really well liked.
It is. It's still selling well on DVD and Blu-ray, as far as I know.
But I think it's important to take that notion of the French Revolution wraparound as a – it's not necessarily a critique within the film. I think it's a larger critique of French culture in a way, if that makes sense. The reason I say that is because Thomas, who is your kind of wraparound narrator who's in and out of the film, he is, as Andrea said, your most sympathetic aristocratic figure. He's likable. He's sweet. He wants to learn. He seems really respectful of everyone. And in the end, he just wants to tell this story. He wants to write it all down, and he hopes that his friends are okay in the end. So I like that it conflates something like the French Revolution, which was so heavily anti-aristocracy, with a quote-unquote good aristocrat. And I think that's kind of leads to a complicated notion of not necessarily the French Revolution, but of circumstance.
Yeah, complicates is a great word for this film because it complicates Enlightenment thinking, it complicates science, it complicates religion, it complicates racism and basic human rights. It's all over the place. Like, it's all mashed together with some sexy sex and some seriously impressive fight scenes into this giant, beautiful mess. But as I mentioned earlier, what's interesting about this film is it kind of uses the werewolf within a historical, real-life context of something that actually happened in France. It uses it as a backdrop to tell a story that's completely different. So insofar as I was saying before that, you know, vampires were this and zombies were that, the werewolf seems to be incredibly malleable as a figure across national lines as well as thematic lines as well as through time.
I think for me, one of the most interesting things about this film is the fact that the titular Brotherhood of the Wolf is like an old aristocratic controlled force.
Like stonemasons or
something. Exactly. Like it's something older than we even know in the film. And so I know we've talked about, and Andrea in particular has talked a lot on this podcast about the way that the upper classes and the aristocracy sought to control the lower classes through means of subjugation, promise of heaven, whatever you were looking at. And I think it's interesting that this film supposes that, obviously, as I talked about earlier, the fear of the wolf, the fear of the werewolf, again, as I mentioned, 30,000 people in France during the medieval times, which granted is a long period, were accused of being werewolves. And this brotherhood utilized that fear to control them, to manipulate them. So I think you can look at this as, you know, Gon's appropriation of historical elements. And a lot of these characters in this film exist in history. They were real at some point. And he coerces them into a bigger fable about control, love, lust, desire, want, need. And again, the kind of notion of godliness, goodness, the devil at war with one another versus the Enlightenment and science and rationalism, which were so huge at that time. So you're looking at something that is clearly black and white with good and evil, God and the devil, versus Fronsac, who is like, maybe it's just some like fucked up animal. Yeah. Which it kind of is. It is. Yeah. Like, that's what it is.
It was a rational explanation. It's not the most satisfying cinematic explanation, the idea that it's a lion in costume. But they did wrap it up somehow. And it's terrorism. The Brotherhood of the Wolf are a terrorist movement, and that is no less relevant. And I've recently had a lot of conversations about just about change and about the time that we're living in. And I have some friends who are kind of on the alarmist side of things, who are just like, oh, yeah, everybody's glued to their phones and it's a breakdown of forms of communication. And like the sociologist in me really bristles at that, in that forms of communication change and they shift. And at every juncture in history, we always look and we're like, oh, this is bad. Things are going bad. Things are going bad. The French Revolution, they honestly thought that things were getting better. Everything's getting better. This is progress on a steep slope up. And now we are in an age of great social change, great technological change, and things look like shit. It's really hard to sit back and say things are getting better. It feels like they're just getting worse and worse. Alex, we were just talking about that today, about how so much has happened that we haven't even internalized, that we're just watching a crazy movie.
And the context for that is at my desk at work. I work at a broadcasting company, and I look up and there's a TV that's always playing a 24-hour Toronto-based news channel. And since Trump came into office, they will broadcast Trump stuff live. And I was writing Andrea on GChat today. I was like, and looked up, and there was live footage of Donald Trump watching a violin player play the violin.
That's on the news.
What is that?
Yeah,
and he was talking about Cuba.
These are weird times that we live in, and it's hard to be optimistic about them, I guess, is what I'm kind of getting at. Is when I look back on this film, there is a sense of this is our history and it's fucked up, but things are on the upswing, and I don't know.
I also had a weird moment with this film when I was like, are we in like weird cultural appropriation territory when Manny dies and Fransac is very much, you know, like, I have to take care of his cremation, I have to do all this stuff. And then he, I guess, dies and gets reborn with all of these like superpowers that Manny seemed to have as like a kung fu expert. It all felt very weird. And I wanted to bring that up because I was watching it and I was like, this is like Dances with Wolves on acid.
Yeah, the politics are very, very murky in this film. I feel like it really tried to elevate First Nations and Native cultures as, don't be prejudiced against them. They have tremendous knowledge and tremendous wisdom, and it's not supernatural, but it's nature. But it's kind of supernatural because you can't tell my spirit animal from my hand. It's sticky. And then you've got these Romani peoples who are just portrayed as total savages throughout. They are puppets of the aristocracy. They are the ones who kept this terrorism train flowing, even though they were ostensibly the lowest class, like the victims of all this terrorist manipulation. So, yeah, this it's murky.
It's interesting because as I was watching it, I kind of picked up on all those elements. And every time I was like, oh, you're trying to do something, you know, cool with Monty and, you know, just be like, treat him like a person, because that's what you should do. It got kind of convoluted with the mysticism around him and
that's
this, like, magical character, and then just the horrific treatment of the Romani characters. And it was this kind of back and forth. And then at the end, it just turns into this, you know, weird, over-the-top cinematic fisticuffs between Vincent Cassel, whose character name I cannot remember because I was just like, oh, Vincent Cassel,
it was Jean-François, same as every French person in cinema.
I love Vincent Cassel.
He did what he could with this. God bless him. I still don't fully understand the deal with the arm. Was he hiding that arm because the arm was evil because of Africa and it wasn't actually severed in Africa? It was just kind of bewitched such that it grew amazing long nails that I like take supplements to try and grow. I don't get it.
One of the few great pleasures of the little bit of industry insider status that I have was from a friend of mine telling me that he has hung out with Vincent Cassel on a few occasions.
No way.
And that he's awesome and he's very cool and he's very nice and he's very gracious.
I
and
tell.
I was like, it would have broken my heart if you had said anything other than that.
He just has that look. He just has that scowl. And I was also thinking back to Irreversible. I failed to make the Monica Bellucci connection, and I didn't know that they were ever a couple.
That's they only recently broke up.
Oh, no way.
Like a few years ago. And it actually, like, that of all the celebrity breakups is the one that I'm still like, oh, yeah. Knife twist in the heart.
That bums me out a little.
Yeah.
Actors who look like bad guys really fascinate me. And in fact, Ron Perlman put out an autobiography in the last couple of years where he just talks about, I had to get cast as these big goons. And I was lucky enough to get a Hellboy character, where it's very sympathetic. He's the hero, but he's still a big monster goon. And so when it comes to Vincent Cassel and watching this film, he just does it so well. Of course you're going to play that sadistic, evil asshole.
If anyone out there is a Vincent Cassel fan and has not seen La Haine, which is the first movie he made, I want to say 95, 96, maybe 94. He made it with Matthew Kasovitz, and it is about the Paris suburbs, and it is dark, and it is grim, but it is fucking amazing.
Cool.
If you're a Vincent Cassel fan or a fan of film, you should watch that.
Right on. I'll put it on my list. So once again, in an episode on a topic of something like werewolves, where it's a figure that can be used in a variety of different ways. It's a figure that's commonly used as a sympathetic victim of circumstance, as in An American Werewolf in London, or it could be used to represent maturity, transformation, puberty, or it could be a backdrop to a giant political terrorist coup. The werewolf is one of the more malleable villains that horror has ever seen, so I hope we did it justice with this episode. We tried to pick the two, I'd say, highlights. There's other werewolf movies that I love. I do so love Ginger Snaps.
I would also like to echo Andrea's sentiments and give shout-outs to a couple other werewolf films I love. I love Neil Jordan's The Company of Wolves. Mm. I love Neil Marshall's Dog Soldiers.
Still haven't seen that.
What?
I know.
I had to watch Brotherhood of the Wolf and you haven't seen Dog Soldiers?
I'll watch it.
Okay, maybe that's Werewolves Part 2 eventually down the line. I love those two films, particularly The Company of Wolves is another film I grew up on. Probably warped me a little too much, but wolves are, as an animal, they're beautiful, they're graceful, they're also vicious. I think werewolves reflect that. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a very cinematic element to werewolves because they can't stand up and start talking to you.
Unless they're like Teen Wolf or
something. Unless they're Teen Wolf, which is a whole other subgenre. See, we have more werewolves to talk about.
No, part 2, 3, 4, and 5.
But when we look at this kind of cinematic monster that we want to talk about, I think the werewolf is such a great one. So to echo Andrea's sentiments, we have started the conversation. I hope down the line, maybe in the next year or two, we'll do a part 2 and we'll keep talking about it because I think there are so many interesting reflections on femininity, masculinity, and who we really are and the kind of things that civility is supposed to have bred out of us.
So before we go, we do have a contest this episode. Room Morgue Library has a new release, and this one is especially near and dear to our hearts because Alex and I have both contributed to it, and because of this book's topic. It is Room Morgue Library Volume 10, and it's entitled Women with Guts. It's written by a close friend of both Alex and mine, Allison Lang, and she did a beautiful job with this book. It is very intimate. It is very personal. If you enjoyed Kayla Janice's House of Psychotic Women and you found that very moving in how personal it got, then you will get a lot out of this as well. We each contributed chapters. Alex wrote about Heather from the Blair Witch Project, and I wrote about Elvira, but there were also contributions from Ashley Blackwell, Lisa Latticer, Monica Kubler, tons of great female horror journalists, and I'm really proud of the book. I'm proud of Allison. I'm proud of Room Morgue. I'm proud of everyone involved, and we've got an autographed copy to give you.
Yeah, I will say my contribution, to be super selfish for a moment, is maybe my favorite thing I've ever written. So consider picking it up. We do have one autographed copy to give away by Allison Lang, and I guess we'll sign it too.
Sure.
Can't hurt, right? Might hurt the resale value. Can't tell you about that, though. You will have to find out for yourself. So, to enter this contest, it is open internationally. So what we're going to ask you to do, so if you follow us on social media, and you should, we're your Faculty of Horror on Facebook and on Twitter, and what we always do every month is when we post a new episode, we pin it to the top of our page, so it's nice and easy to find. What you have to do is comment on that post, the episode post, this werewolf episode post on either Twitter or Facebook, whatever your preferred poison is. And we've just got so many listeners and you're all over the place and you all tell us the cool things you do while you listen to us, whether it's driving a car or jogging or sitting down. All of those things are so interesting to us.
Sitting down and thinking about flowers. Making a loom.
But you all have so many different lives. You're all over the world. And I think it's really cool. Andrea thinks it's really cool. So our task for you is to take a photo right now, wherever you are. I assume you're listening on your phone. If you're not by your phone that has a camera, find it, grab it. Take the nearest photo you can of something non-offensive, something that won't get us flagged on Facebook or Twitter. And, I don't know, show us your viewpoint from when you listen to Faculty of Horror.
Yeah, I mean, we consider you guys part of the conversation. We really do. I think it's hard to conceptualize, even for us, when we're sitting in this room. But I feel like we're talking to a great unknown. And so we'd love to see you. And so this contest will run until July 1st. And to enter, do just as Alex said. And we will pick at random and get your information and send that off.
An OTRA announcement. We announced it last month, and we're going to keep talking about it until it happens, because gosh darn it, are we excited. Salem Horror is still happening. We are still going to be at Salem Horror on October 7th and October 8th. We will be at the Q&A for Friday the 13th, Part 4. We will be talking to Kane Hodder, and then we will be at a very, very special event, which I'm so excited about, inspired by the title for the book we just talked about, Women with Guts, and we will be doing a party with Salem Horror celebrating women in horror and having cocktails and hanging out. And that's going to be super fun on the Saturday night. And then on Sunday, October 8th, we are doing our first ever live show in Salem, Massachusetts. We have decided to align with the film program for that evening, and we're going to be doing an episode, the live episode, about American Psycho.
As Alex said, the programming for that night is a double header of American Psycho and Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And Texas Chainsaw Massacre was one of our first episodes, I want to say, maybe the first year.
First year.
So we've already talked about that, but American Psycho is a movie that we've been meaning to tackle. So what better opportunity? Tickets are available now if you can make it out to Salem, but otherwise that will be an episode that we'll publish. So we're really looking forward to it.
But make sure you get to the live show, because then you will get to see or infer the magic of Andrea's editing.
Oh, no, no.
You're going to have so many problems, dude.
Why
I can't even tell you.
That?
But yeah, currently the plan is to record there, have lots of fun with the live audience, do a ton of stuff live. And we'll see what we can mash together for an episode eventually down the line. But maybe it'll be unsalvageable. Maybe it'll go off the rails. Maybe Andrea and I will never speak after that episode. Who knows?
Maybe our plane will crash on our way to Salem. Maybe we'll die tomorrow.
I was trying to get them to buy tickets, Andrea.
I know, but you're going down a dark path.
We are on the darkest timeline. Maybe. Who knows? So buy a ticket at salemhorror.com. We're going to link it in the show notes. It's, I think, a very reasonable price, especially when you look at what these other podcast festivals are charging. It's a great event run by great people. Please check it out. Check the show notes for links, all that good kind of stuff.
Okay, and with all that said, before all the Salem goodness, we have another summer episode before we take our hiatus. And our July episode, we're going to a land down under.
All right, Sheila, Bruce.
I'm not going to let Alex do that in the episode. Don't worry.
Oh, I'm going to do it so much.
If you haven't guessed, we are going to tackle Australian horror. We've got a pair of films that we've selected. We're going to be looking at The Loved Ones and Wolf Creek. So another pair of highly requested movies. We have so many requested movies, and we really do take note of all of your suggestions and requests. But that's your homework for next episode.
And until next time, Sheila and Bruce.
Office hours are closed.
Lay hands on me and run my melody. Sugar Glenn Show.